marine mammals in Alaska's waters are suffering from an unknown ailment that causes hair loss and lesions. The search goes on for the cause. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The sea ice is opening up and subsistence seal hunting is underway. Alaskans are seeing more than anyone right now, and what you have seen is welcome information at 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. The experts on the unusual mortality event are here today on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, this is basically designed to be a communication exercise and a bit of an update on how far we've gotten in figuring out the unusual mortality event, which is mortal for seals and also affecting other marine mammals. Might not even be the exact same thing that's happening in each case, and there's a whole lot more to be looking into, but it can be fatal for seals. And so in line with that, we've got a couple of experts in the studio, and we have other experts on the telephone. They're all connected into the show. Just to simplify things, I think we'll kind of hold our polar bear expert in reserve, but to say hi to him right now. Dr. Todd Atwood is at the U.S. Geological Service and joins us by telephone. Dr. Atwood, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
All right. It's great to have you. And joining us from Nome is Gay Sheffield, who is with the Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program. Gay Sheffield, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. And in the studio is Joel Garlick Miller. He's walrus expert with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Joel, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning, Alaska.
Yeah, and how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for hosting us and holding this important show.
Yeah, it's going to be probably pretty wild. And sitting next to him is Kathy Burek Huntington, a veterinarian and pathologist at Alaska Veterinary Pathology Services. Kathy, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Kathy, maybe I can start with you, because what everybody wants to know is, have they found the cause of this thing that it's been killing seals?
The short answer is no. The longer answer is that we've ruled out an awful lot of possible causes. There's been a very extensive and wide-ranging investigation so far, and we've been able to rule out a lot of the obvious choices for viral agents, for example, bacteria. And now we're continuing to work down the list of different toxics and environmental factors.
Yeah. And included in the things that seem to have been ruled out is radiation?
We have done some analyses for radiation, and so far the analysis look like it's at pretty much background level. So I would say yes, it's been ruled out as the primary cause of this problem.
Now, it's my understanding, I mean, if I were exposed to intense radiation, I might experience some hair loss and so forth like that. There are acute radiation symptoms. Wouldn't necessarily show on my body, right?
Right. Yeah, the hair loss, and we're also seeing quite a lot of immunosuppressive kind of changes in these animals. So these are things that led us to think that the ruling out the radiation poisoning was a reasonable thing to do, right?
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. Joel Garlick Miller, tell me, you're a walrus expert, and it was found rather quickly, I guess, that walruses were also being affected by this, but it was rarely fatal. It was not fatal for them, as far as we know.
Well, we have, with respect to walruses, we started seeing hearing reports of up on the Arctic coast of Alaska at a large coastal haulout that formed there, reports of walruses with some unusual skin lesions. And this was very similar to what had been reported to many ring seals showing up in the same region. So we did some sampling at the haul-out site. We did a carcass survey. We did find some dead animals, but most of those animals appear to have died from trauma. The animals, of course, are in these big, dense herds, and disturbance can cause interspecific sort of crushing injuries. So we found a number of calves that were dead, but most of them appear to have been crushed. We did find these unusual lesions, which we couldn't explain, and so we collected a lot of samples that have been forwarded.
Joel, that sounds like really difficult work.
Well, it's kind of stinky work.
But yeah, I know that.
But it was a really neat field season. There's a success story I'd like to talk to you about another time about the local community of Point Lay have been really sort of showing this stewardship of this big haul out that they've had up there. And so the mortality rates have been surprisingly low. And but we've been working a lot with the community. They're a big part of doing this sort of carcass survey. Local folks going out there and enumerating carcasses and collecting biological samples. And so that's fed into this investigation. But to get to your point, we did not see a lot of really sick or dead animals there. We did find a couple of specimens, and we sampled them intensely and did a necropsy. And it turned out that, Kathy's done a lot of the summary work on that, but the animals appeared to have died from secondary infections rather than directly from some virus or something.
Right. Of course, when the seals die from this process, it looks like it's primarily from secondary infections also. So the two species have in common those ulcerative lesions that seem to be related to inflammation of the blood vessels feeding that part of the skin. Both the walrus and the seals have that very much in common. And then when the seals die on the beach, it's generally from secondary bacterial or fungal infections of organisms that wouldn't normally kill them. Yeah.
I see. So you find, for instance, people say, well, it could be a fungus. It kind of is a fungus. It can be.
You can find a fungus, yes. Yeah. But the important thing is to find out what the primary cause of the process is. And a result, or not a result, but something that's helped us a lot with this is our hunter-killed animals that are submitted to us tend to be very early on in the process. And so they're actually quite key samples for us to look at, because they are killed during the subsistence hunt early on in the process before they get to the point where all the secondary problems are developing and confusing the issue. So those cases, and the awareness of our native community has really contributed a lot to this investigation. It's been very important.
I think we'll switch it out to Noam and Gay Sheffield, who is working directly with, I guess, subsistence hunters on this. Gay, can you tell me what kind of things this year's subsistence hunters are reporting in terms of this disease and how widespread they might be seeing it?
Sure. First off, I just wanted to say that I'm not the expert in the subsistence harvest. I'm surrounded by experts here in Bering Strait, and we have, thanks to their efforts, been able to move a little bit closer to getting an understanding of what this situation is with the sea mammals. So what people are reporting here in the Bering Strait region out to St. Lawrence Island and into Norton Sound and even a little bit further north up the coast is that some of these seals, we've gotten about reports on 20 seals, bearded and ring seals, that hunters have gotten, and they are seeing massive hair loss, which is not surprising given that seals only grow their hair during the summer months. And whatever afflicted these animals started before the molt last year. So they went into the fall not growing their hair. So what happened was, people say their hair is falling off, but actually what happened was their old coat never got pushed out by new hair. So when their old coat started to, naturally fall out, which it would anyway, there was no new hair underneath, and that's why they look so bald. So this spring, now the seals have not had the opportunity to grow their hair back yet. So all winter they've been having the opportunity to wear off their hair, their old coat, and nothing came last summer. So they're seeing seals that look very, I guess you'd call them very bald. And those, to me, that's somewhat of good news in that those seals are likely to have been survivors through our very hard winter this year, and they've made it. In not terribly good shape, some have sores and other problems when we are able to get those into the vets. But again, I take that as they're survivors. And right now, we haven't seen or heard from the clinical side of things that we have any sort of new cases unfolding. Again, since we don't know where we are in this disease, every report that people can give us about what they're seeing along the coast is terribly important.
Thank you. Kathy Burek-Huntington, would you go along with this guess that it could be that the worst of it might have passed?
I think that's actually quite difficult to predict. And just to kind of take it on a slightly different tangent is that as we've developed the case definitions in this investigation, we've actually split out into having two separate case definitions for the seals, because even last year, particularly the animals in the Bering Strait, some of the cases were strictly hair loss. They're pretty much bald seals. And those kind of cases we've seen for quite a few years now, but very sporadically, usually reported by our subsistence hunters who are concerned about seals that are bald. But this year we had a particularly high level of those kind of cases. So it seems to be somehow connected to this other case. The other type of case is something totally new that hasn't been reported except one other case quite a few years ago where you have these ulcerative or the open weeping lesions in the seals in addition to hair loss. So it actually seems to me like we have two different types of cases occurring that are somehow connected but not exactly the same. Perhaps they have the initial similar etiology or cause from the beginning, and then the ones with the ulcers, the sores, have something else on top of whatever overriding cause they have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's you know, it's one of these Alaska things that as a journalist, you try and make a story. Okay, here's the story. And then when you actually start getting closer and closer to the facts, there's such remoteness, such difficulty of getting information and assembly of the information that the whole thing gets a whole lot bigger.
It's gotten very big, very quickly, I must say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let me see if I can try and untangle this a little bit here, Joel. Maybe you can help me. How do we know that? I mean, we know marine conditions have changed. I mean, for your walrus, they've changed enormously. These female walruses have been having their calves. The sea ice is like gone out from under them. They're having to forage from on shore instead of on the ice. They clearly are subject to tons and tons of new stresses. Even water temperature is different, and the organisms in the water are different. Couldn't it just simply be that there's been so much stress that they're breaking out?
I think that's a very good but complicated question. when we first started getting these reports, both in seals and subsequently walruses, we decided that it was significant enough that the government agencies decided to declare this unusual mortality event. And what this did is help trigger a sort of a broader scale investigation. And so we actually have a very broad coalition of experts working on various aspects of this. We've got the samples coming in from and reports from the hunters, which are, really key to scoping out the geography of it. That helps it inform, the geographical extent of this, the species involved. We've got a group of pathologists and stuff who are looking very closely viruses and trying to culture bacteria to try to determine cause. And that's one aspect of it. But, you know, as the answers, if we don't get immediate results on those, on that hit, we've also broadened the investigation to do things like the radionuclides. We wanted to rule that out. But we're also going to look at contaminants and environmental factors to see these things. Part of the moving challenge is that we don't know the full scale of this event, and as you have suggested optimistically, that whether it has passed or if it's something that is reoccurring. So this year, this sampling year, offers a great opportunity to try to answer that. We've got we've established a broad network of a reporting network for subsistence hunters and people looking for stranded animals, and we've sharpened our pens to figure out what we've analyzed so far, and so we're reaching deeper into some of the other potential causes.
So, Kathy, how many people in the forensic area are actually working this?
Oh, I haven't counted them up, actually. But you know, even before we declared this as a UME, we started working with it's called a UME working group. So very early on in the process, and that involves, I don't know how many people, but at least 15 under my diagnostic group, perhaps 20. And,
wow. So for instance, let's take virus. It's my understanding, testing for virus is not all that simple, because there's all kinds of virus around all
right,
the time.
It's quite complicated.
and so you have to test for a virus.
Right.
And so let's try this one. Okay, let's try that one. No, it's not that one. It's this and that. And then I think there's also maybe even a sample situation here, because you've got two different cases, as you say. One is the lesions, and the other is the hair loss, however that works with the molt and all.
Right.
And so you can't always, any pathologist often has trouble definitively determining cause of death.
Right.
So you don't know. Yeah. So, well, was it the lesion? Was it the what? You know, you don't necessarily know. Whether it's was mortality or it's just there's something wrong with the skin here.
Right. To go back to just talking about the virus issue, the approaches that we've taken so far is we've tried virus culture on the lesions and also the livers, because they also tend to have a bit of hepatitis is very common in these animals. And virus culture, the advantage of that is you're just trying to grow a virus. And so you don't have to specifically be looking at a particular virus. And use lots of different cell lines to try to grow those viruses, and those have all been negative. And then there's molecular techniques in which you actually have a little probe for a particular virus, and you just choose the ones that make sense for what your lesion looks like. And all of those have been negative. And then we've gone forward to a very, very fancy high-throughput molecular technique at Columbia University. And these labs, it's a discovery lab, pathogen discovery lab, and they can use very expensive, fancy analyses to try.
I knew that word expensive was coming
up.
Yeah.
and these are people that are going around the world looking for emerging pathogens, and they're very interested in helping us out with this problem. And so we have gotten a few possibilities as viral causes for the initial lesions, but we haven't so far confirmed that they are the cause. And so we're going through some of the more rigorous testing to see if they might possibly be involved, because a problem with those very fancy techniques is you can always pick up something, you know, because we do actually carry a variety of viruses on ourselves, and animals do, and some of them are even integrated into your genome, your DNA. And so just finding them does not give you the answer, is it the cause? So right. That's where we are on now with the two possibilities, both of which are immunosuppressive, which fit quite nicely with, you know, what we're seeing in these animals. So they're interesting possibilities, but not definitive as cause. Yeah.
So then let's turn to the fungus. Now that you can, the fungus is already there too.
Yeah. So I mostly think the funguses are secondary, because they, just they're always around. You know, they're very low pathogen type funguses, so they're just, you know, things that are present that are growing on an animal that's compromised. And we're also investigating, looking at other factors like endocrine function, because that's a very important part of the animal's system for producing a normal molt. And certain contaminants, like the persistent organic pollutants, can affect the endocrine system. There are these endocrine disruptors I'm sure a lot of people have heard about. So we're going to be also investigating down that trail at the same time.
Man, that sounds like another very complicated trail.
Yeah.
Maybe even expensive trail.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah.
But yeah, there was one of our email commenters brought that exact thing up. This one from Bruce: with such dramatic changes in the Arctic due to climate change, why didn't our scientific community predict these dramatic changes? Will any of you be willing to speculate what we might see next with Arctic marine mammals? Okay, Joel, that's your hardball.
Well, as you pointed out in your introduction, I'm a walrus guy, so I can give you a walrus specific answer. You know, they're people have talked conceptually and theoretically about Arctic climate change, loss of sea ice habitat on marine mammal species. With walruses, the future is here. We have seen some rather dramatic changes in sea ice habitat in the last decade or so that has changed animals' distributions and habitat use patterns. So they're occupying new areas, forced to feed in different geographical regions, and things like that. So it's not clairvoyant to really predict what will happen, because it is happening. So, you know, there's a lot of new stressors that are coming to the Arctic. We have, with the opening of the sea ice, we have a lot more human activity, commercial activities coming up into the Arctic, and a lot more interactions with humans and things like that. You know, I think a lot of these species have survived periods in the past. This isn't the first time ice-free conditions have hit the Arctic. How they adapt is difficult to say. We don't have a lot from the fossil records. I think they probably shift their distributions to find sweet habitat spots and things like that.
But, well, yeah, I mean, in a walrus, I mean, we both know a whole bunch more that go over the Russian side. Point Lay was not any place where they were hauling out before, but now it is. I mean, you know, those are changes.
They are some big changes. And
you can see, I guess now when you're with remote sensing, you can better track and see that little bit of ice that hangs out over Hannah Shoal a little bit later. You know, they're almost always on that until it goes away. The ice, when it gets out to where it's deep, some of them are still on that for some reason.
Steve, you've been doing your research.
Yeah.
Actually, well, doing the best I can.
That's fantastic. So there are all these stressors coming, and they're likely to amplify in the future. I guess I don't want to leave on a gloom and doom note, however. The animals are quite adaptive. They are. What's different nowadays is there's the human element. There's a lot more people in the Arctic. There are a lot of activities up and down the coast, for example, where walruses are now coming along the coast. But managing humans is something we can actually do. You know, the animals aren't necessarily disappearing because of the loss of sea ice. They're changing their habitat patterns.
Yeah, well, according to that climate series that the Johanna York just produced that ran last week on Alaska Public Radio Network, it was pretty much some people in Point Lay itself who went around and suggested all the things that ought to be done to protect this rookery.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. It's a huge conservation success story. People have, local communities are stepping
including
up.
Including with the aircraft?
Absolutely.
Everything.
Yep. So, you know, I try to remain optimistic, and I think that there's a lot of willing partners to try to create space for these animals, help them get through these times. So
not to push my own publications, but I was involved in a special edition in Ecological Applications quite a few years ago, where we did talk about how how climate change may potentially affect the health of Arctic marine mammals. And some of the predictions were that some of the infectious disease patterns could very well change because of changes in the environment. You know, infectious disease agents may be able to survive in the environment longer because of changes in temperature. You might have vectors moving further south, I mean, further north than previously seen because of the changes. And the problem is it's very hard to predict which, you know, what's going to really happen. But it seems like there's a lot of different things that could happen that could affect the health. Even, you know, if there's less ice for them to congregate on, they're going to be more condensed. So there's also could be density-dependent effects that often affect the infectious disease transmission.
Man.
Kind of like think of a stockyard or something. You know, there's a lot of other things that happen there versus when animals are spread out.
Yeah, I guess, you know, there could also be changes in the prey that would create stresses.
Change in the food. You like they're eating something different. They might even be exposed to something different from that, or the nutritional values not the same.
Look at human beings are getting PSP. You know, there it is.
Yeah.
Okay, I think I'll turn to Gay Sheffield again in Nome. Gay, you say that you're trying to stay fairly in touch out there in Nome, and I wanted to give a little bit of more time to you to talk about the scope of the situation. You mentioned, I think, that it was both bearded and ring seals in which this hairless situation is being seen now.
Yeah, that's correct. Also, I just wanted to remind people that this is a huge food security issue along our coast. And while we've been talking recently about all the different testings and scary things that are unknown in the future, I just would like to point out that we have no evidence that this issue that's happening with the seals is transferable to people or to animals. And that there are lots of healthy seals out there. Right now we have an ongoing subsistence harvest. This is extremely important along our coast. And though this topic is kind of a little bit creepy, our job is to focus on the sick ones, and that's why we're talking so much about these sick ones. But I would like to remind listeners we do have plenty of healthy seals out there as well. What people are seeing, typically seals are tired or not. Their behavior is not very alert, so someone may try to harvest a seal and miss, and typically the seals will jump off the ice or go down their hole, and in some cases they are not. And this has been occurring since last summer, where we have this very, the word's lethargic, but it's, you know, they're very tired or not their usual behavior. Again, with no new hair growth, as the fall progressed and now into the spring, they have large amounts of just skin showing without hair. They look pretty rugged. And in some cases, they also have lesions, which is just another word for sores on their skins or disturbances on their skins. So, again, we've gotten about 20, I'd say a little over 20 reports of bearded and ring seals. And people are doing a fantastic job of not only reporting, taking photos. We have people that are taking calls and are focal points around the state. The North Slope Borough is actually the lead on this. The North Slope Borough and Barrows Department of Wildlife Management is the lead for the this whole designated unusual mortality event, and they've been doing a fantastic job of also taking reports, collecting carcasses, and doing a lot of the veterinary work, as well as Kathy Burek down in Anchorage.
All right. I want to thank you for that, and I have a whole list of phone numbers, and right after the break that we're about to take, I'll just list down through the phone numbers that I have, then we'll collect the more of them, and I think there's some 800 numbers that people can use, and we'll put all that up on the website once we get the program posted from today on the website. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life.
Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
It is Talk of Alaska, and as promised, here are some contact numbers. The Eskimo Whaling Commission, Eskimo Walrus Commission, is 1-877-277-4392. Marine Advisory Program, 443-2397. North Slope Borough, which is doing a lot of the collecting here, is 852-0350. And we're speaking about today on Talk of Alaska about the unusual mortality event affecting seals, but also other marine mammals are coming up with this kind of hairlessness and lesion problem as well. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. We'd love to have you call with your observations, what you actually might have seen this seal season. And I think we need to step back at this point and really talk about the human health aspects of this. I mean, we're talking about these animals that are unhealthy. These are some animals. And Gay Sheffield, there's no indication, is there, that any human has been harmed by consuming anything involving a diseased marine mammal of the sort.
That's correct. You know, the initially, we called state public health, you know, what to do about these seals, and really they could only tell us about you know, some very good general advice, like cook the meat. But for the subsistence community, there are many ways you utilize a seal, including organs, the oil, and really the best knowledge has been in the communities themselves, and people have been very good about asking elders or, you know, following their traditional and customary rules regarding salvage and consumption of seals that don't look right. And really that system has been working. We have people who have eaten from some of these seals, and I actually am one of them. But and nothing has been reported. Also, people utilize seal meat for dog teams as well, and animals have been fed this. And again, so far so good.
So it's been taken to the public health authorities as best that we have, and in a lot of ways the advice, and I never thought I would actually see the day when this would actually happen on a radio program where I could say, after all the years working with cooperative extension and so forth that I've been through, 50 years of it, to actually say the best advice on how to prepare, whether if this animal doesn't look right, how you should handle it, is to go to the elders. I can't tell you. I am so relieved that I can actually say that. I just think that's truly wonderful.
Well, we actually had a
circle.
Sorry.
And I think people should recognize the expertise that is in the communities, especially in a situation where we have something unknown like this. For the marine mammal community, this is new. People have been doing a great job of alerting the veterinarian, biologists, and trying to get communication going. I think it's fantastic that, like Kathy Burek, Joel, everybody's involved. It's a tough issue, but I think what's really come out of it is that people are communicating more, and that's probably the most important thing.
Well, I'm very happy that NOAA Fisheries came to us and said, hey, let's put this on the radio. I mean, people really just need to be more free with our information here. And we got our two experts that came into the studio, and they're more than happy to lend their expertise and tell us what they know and what they don't know, which is also a great thing. But in this case, you know, we got a central mystery. I mean, we got to admit we don't know.
Right. Yeah. And I was just going to say, we did have a workshop in January for discussing this with a bunch of experts, which included the Ice Seal Commission individuals and the
The Walrus Commission.
Walrus Commission, and that's where it really solidified it for me that the advice the elders are giving is very consistent with what makes sense, you know, coming from my perspective of things too. So that's following their traditional and customary uses is just very important in this.
I get one from Tom here who says, how can you be leaving out radiation? The unknown radiation that came out of Fukushima might still be coming out of. We know we got a plume of cesium in the water. We have this debris that's coming ashore. How can you be so sure?
Well, so far from the testing that we have done, we haven't ignored it. Is looking like it's background, and then there hasn't been further testing since. I understand it just came to shore. Was it last week or 2 weeks ago? There was more.
Well, no, you just found it out 2 weeks ago on a bunch of it.
Montague.
Right. Yeah. So we'll continue taking samples to look at that, but it just wouldn't be the primary initial cause for last year. So.
Yeah. So just forensic detective work.
Yep.
It's eliminate it because it ain't there.
Yeah. Or, it's at background levels of what is all generally in the environment. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. And a radiation exposure to cause hair loss would be huge.
It'd be huge. Yeah, it would really be huge.
Let's go to Joanne, joins the program from Unalakleet. Joanne, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, good morning. Good conversation. Interesting.
Good morning.
I'm just wondering if there's a connection between what is happening or what has happened within the caribou population. I know there are some reports that I'm hearing from elders and from other hunters that some caribou over the years have had certain kinds of sicknesses where the people have refused to eat them. I know personally I have cut into a caribou and boiled the bones and the meat, etc. And after I was done, I said, I am not going to eat this thing. It smells too bad. And it wasn't necessarily from rot.
Right.
And then my next question is, has there been any study within the human population of those people who are eating the walrus and seals and whatnot? And I think if there hasn't been, I think it's important that studies begin.
All right. Yeah. Thank you. Would be a challenge, I think. Because you have to have some baseline to get any kind of epidemiology. You have to deal with pretty big samples.
Right. And, I can assure you that if we do come up with a very likely cause for these problems that it is a viral agent, there will be discussions about human testing. But, that's kind of it's a bit of a touchy issue, and it would have to be collaborative with the native communities and worked out through the public health department. But right now, we don't really have something that we could test that would be reasonable to link to what's going on with the seals and the walrus.
No, she asked a specific question about, some observations on caribou. I mean, part of it was not smelling right. And even though it looked right, not smelling right, well, okay, I'm not eating it. Probably a good decision.
Yeah, I think just follow those kind of decisions with those kind of issues.
But as far as anything known between any kind of link that would, something that would be in the water for these marine mammals and something that would be on the land for these caribou.
Right. There's a lot of things that wildlife animals can get, so it's not all going to all be linked. There's going to be all kinds of different possible causes. An animal can smell abnormal when you cook it if it's had an abnormal amount of nutritional support. It's very, very thin, and so it's metabolizing things abnormally. It can also be if they have a, bacterial infection systemically. So it's very hard to say, but it seems like it'd be a very long shot that they would be related to what's going on in the marine mammals at this point.
Joanne?
Yeah, I just have one more question.
Go ahead.
I know in... I don't want to scare anybody, but I'm really concerned about this. some of the more major epidemic, you know, outbreaks of certain diseases in the world occurred as a result of the virus was found, let's say, in the snout or in the nose of some pig. I can't remember which.
What was found?
Epidemic it was.
What was found?
But a certain virus.
Virus, yes.
Well,
and it spread from the animal to the human population.
I see what you're saying.
Yes, most of the emerging pathogens that people are looking at actually originate in animal species, particularly wildlife, actually. So that's why there's going to be more support for looking, following up on these kind of things in wildlife. But as we said before, there's been no indication that there is transmission of whatever this is to people at this time. And we are working internationally with people in Canada, and there's some conversation with folks in Russia. And so it's, you know, people are looking pretty extensively at this.
You know, it occurs to me that scientists kind of don't like to get out on a limb speculation-wise. And the difference between speculation and prediction is maybe arcane. But, you know, we had a question earlier about the lack of predictions. You responded and said, well, we actually did say we'd likely to see these sort of things.
Right.
Do you have any more? With climate warming, it would be likely that we would see things you would like to bring up?
I think, well, like in the marine mammals, we could see differences in what they're eating, their body condition. You know, these things are all possible. And, you know, other disease factors we might not be thinking about right now. it's pretty much where I'm at.
It's an exciting time scientifically because change is underway. So we watch it. And
right.
Then we see it move, and then we say, well, it might move this way.
Right. Well, the problem with the climate change issue is that whether things are actually linked to climate changes. You know, you can see these changes in the seals and the walrus. You see the changes in the environment, but it's going to be very difficult to actually link the two as a cause versus just coincidence.
You've got other things,
you know,
things you probably haven't looked at, like
right.
They're only starting to measure the pH.
Right, pH.
In all the Arctic waters. You know, because, I mean, maybe you break out when the water is a little more acid.
Right. Well, we've actually kind of talked about that in
really?
Some of our groups, you know, that this is, and I think the environmental part of the investigation is looking into things like that.
I can see that being so hard to tie down. I mean, you almost take laboratory tests and things you have to expose animals to see how they responded. I mean, that's what they're having to do with even the simplest things,
right.
The little tiny things. Right now, the acidification people are all about building bigger tanks.
One thing I'm conscious of, we may sound very sort of cautious in the information we're sharing, but that's part of that reason in not wanting to speculate about things too much is, you know, we are talking about people's food. And, you know, when all these things are theoretically possible, these vectors are emerging and things like that. But we're trying to strike a balance of giving out factual information where we have it so people can make informed decisions. But we don't want to sort of erode people's confidence in the food resources they have out there.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, part of the wonderful thing is that Kathy here comes out of the, not so much the public health area, but the veterinary area.
Right.
Where they don't worry about the animals getting all panicky because they hear that, you know, there's too much mercury in the environment or something like that. You come out of the wildlife management area.
Mm-hmm.
You've got this horrible problem of, you know, this very remote wildlife, very hard to observe that you have to try and manage. And there's hardly any people in your whole department to manage. You know, so you have that problem. So you're not also in the public health paradigm. If we had public health people here, it'd be totally impossible. They wouldn't want to talk about it at all.
Because it's just gonna
scare people. So I understand your concern.
Yeah.
But I have to tell you, as a media person who believes people have the right to make up
Absolutely.
Their own minds about things, I'm very refreshed that you're here.
I'll just point out that we recognize all these strengths and weaknesses that people bring to the table. And so that's why we really are consciously trying to put together a coalition. We've got some excellent input from seasoned subsistence hunters who have seen this in the land and can give that historical perspective. We've got some really smart vets and pathologists and folks investigating it. And one thing that's different about this UME here in Alaska is the fact that it is a subsistence food. In other areas, people, just investigate stranded dead marine mammals. But we're actually getting cooperation from a lot of hunters out there, letting us essentially sample their food pot. We're trying to get that information back out to them, as you say, to make informed decisions. And the human health folks here in Alaska are very progressive. They recognize that there's
they're on the frontier.
Yeah.
They know it, yeah.
They recognize the value of subsistence foods, and they try to make sure that people put these risks in perspective. This is very good food and what is available in the community. Probably better for you than a lot of the imported stuff that comes
absolutely.
In. So, I think that's a point that bears stressing. There's a lot of healthy animals out there. There's no current recommendations at any level not to continue with that practice.
And Gay Sheffield, to go back it out to you in Nome, just before we take a break, I had a question here from Ken, who says, I am wondering, and we did go into this a couple of times, but I think it bears repeating. I'm wondering how the number of 26 seals compares to the number of seals this year that are not sick that have been harvested in subsistence hunts. Do we have any sense of proportion about that?
It's a very good question.
Hello, Gay Sheffield, you know?
I was on... thanks, I got that. And I think it's a great question. We do not know comparatively how many seals have been taken this spring versus those, 25 or 6 seals. However, I can tell you that we're hearing about, though more people are calling in from other regions, really we were a little bit more sort of overwhelmed with these seals last fall. And I know that's a sort of a data-free opinion, but that's all we've got right now. It doesn't seem, given the large effort going on, and like I said, people are getting healthy seals, that we're seeing that same initial pulse. People are calling these in and sending them in. Hopefully we'll even actually have one this afternoon. That's why I was on mute. And so that the veterinarians can take a look at it. Again, I'll be interested to see what they find, whether these are all survivors from last year. And, you had a thing where it was mortal for seals. It was mortal for seals, but at a time. I think also, though, that seals have been able to survive through this, and we'll see how long they're able to either keep this up, heal, or whether we have new cases. And again, that's why it's so important that your listeners are if they're on the coast and they see any seals acting abnormal, if they have sores or big patches of hair missing, give a call. Call into the numbers that'll be on the website and also that Steve's giving out. It'd be very important.
Okay, do we have a method in place for people to report the numbers of normal seals? Are you hearing about those too, so we can get an idea as the percentage?
The typically the seals are not. That would be a question for National Marine Fisheries Service on how they document the harvest, and also for there is the subsistence division with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game that does household surveys. Again, I'm not too familiar with how that structure is set up, but
Okay. Well, there are two that I personally and definitely know were harvested. There was no problem with. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has over 70 job openings available statewide in nursing, social work, and child protection. There's nothing more important than protecting the health and well-being of Alaska families, so take the first step towards a meaningful career.
Visit dhss.alaska.gov and click on careers. Join their team and make a difference every day. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about marine mammals and the unusual mortality event affecting seals and others, and sometimes mortal, sometimes not. And maybe it's just a matter of the hair, not the old hair, not going out. That's very interesting.
It's more a factor.
They molt. They do molt, right?
Right. Yep. That should.
And so if the old hair didn't go out, how can the new hair come in?
Well, it's not directly linked, really. But so they normally have a molt in late May, June, maybe into July, in which the old kind of ratty-looking coat falls out, and then they grow the new hair. So, I mean, the falling out is expected and normal, but the abnormality is that they're not growing in the new hair. Yeah.
I see. And yet you can go in there with a microscope and see where the hair should have come from, but it didn't?
I can actually see in some cases where the new follicles, or the part that holds the hair, started to develop for the new hair, and then it atrophied or kind of degenerated before it could actually produce the new hair.
We had one question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air, but said, is it possible that the increasing atmospheric environmental pollution load from China might be a part of this? And we sort of indirectly answered that contaminants are still a possibility.
We still don't have any analyses back on the persistent organic pollutants, the things like DDT, DDE, PCBs. But we do have several submitted to the laboratories to get that kind of information back. And we also are looking into heavy metals, because we have a couple of mines that, you know, are in the areas that kind of look at whether we have background or if something unusual spiked last year. Again, we're just still waiting for those kind of analyses. We have done analyses for PCPs and domoic acid, which are forms of harmful algal bloom toxins. And those have all been negative or at insignificantly low levels. So we do have those analyses back.
You look at the things you can look at.
Right. Exactly.
One thing, we don't have results back from the six seals sampled here on some of these contaminants. But also, just a historical perspective, there have been sampling programs for a lot of these things, persistent organic chlorines and heavy metal things. And again, trying to put things in balance and perspective, here in Alaska, we have been historically quite fortunate because of atmospheric conditions and things that we have relatively pristine waters, and these levels compared to other parts of the Arctic have been historically quite low.
Right, so we have a baseline as to what's the expected levels of a lot of these things, too. And to have such a big change last year, we'd expect to see, if it's related to the contaminants, a big change in those levels.
Now, you don't want to totally let Dr. Atwood off the hook, so I'm going to try and call him in here in his office at the USGS for this one here. There was a meeting earlier this year in which some Russians came over. He's mostly talking about walrus and other marine mammals, but one guy came over and said that elders had told him that they had seen this before, this hairless condition before, in polar bears on the Russian side long ago, and that it was related to having to swim around in the water too much, probably, or that was the guess of the elders, and that, as I understand it, and you can tell me more, Dr. Atwood, was kind of the spur to actually take a look at polar bears and see if these symptoms might be appearing there.
Well, Steve, I'm not familiar with that meeting, but what I can tell you is that there has been instances of hair loss, hair thinning observed in polar bears going as far back as 1998, 1999 for the USGS Polar Bear Project. And Dr. Burek Huntington was involved in the investigation from that period. Basically, in the winter of 1998-1999, I think about 19% of the polar bears that were captured during normal field work showed some signs of hair loss and hair thinning. Since that time, There have been sporadic cases in our project. There have been other cases reported by some scientists from Canada. And then in 2012, of course, we have this occurrence where nearly 30% of the bears that we captured had some signs of hair loss and hair thinning. You know, at this point with polar bears, it's really important to note that there's no evidence that links what we're seeing in polar bears to what's happening in seals and walruses. But given that seals are a primary prey species for polar bears, and given the extent of what's happening there, there's certainly cause for concern. And out of that concern, we've coordinated our research efforts very closely with the unusual mortality event group. And so we're working with Dr. Bira Cunnington, working with a lot of the labs that that group is also working with, so that we're not reinventing the wheel on our end. But yeah, it has been occurring. And as yet, there's no smoking gun on what's causing it. It might be environmental. It might be nutritional. It could be something as simple as ice building up on the coat and pulling out patches of hair. That's been observed before in polar bears, too. What makes us think that it's not a simple explanation is that we're also seeing oral lesions. We're seeing lesions on the skin, things that make us think that it's something a little bit more than just an ice buildup, which is then pulling out hair.
All right. Thanks a lot, Dr. Atwood. And we have pretty well come to the end of the rope here, you guys. We will try and take every phone number that Gay Sheffield or anybody else gives us and get it on the website for people so they can participate in this dialogue. And we have one question from Diana. Says, hey, where is Noah or Nymphs? Well, they're right in the middle of all this. it was Noah that basically rounded up the panel for this program.
That's right. Yep.
And I really think this is really interesting. I mean, Dr. Atwood is telling me, well, you know, the polar bears eat a lot of seals, and he's concerned, and yet the public health side, we don't seem to be concerned. People eat seals too.
I don't have much to say to that.
No,
yeah.
No.
I think the other point that Todd was making, though, is that at this point there isn't any sort of drawn connection between the two. It was, many of these questions remain because we need to find out what has caused this.
Right. Time's up.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for having
next
us.
Next week, Senator Mark Begich. Thanks so much to Dave Waldron, Josh Edge. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.